I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. On April 15th, 1947, Jackie Robinson took to the field on opening day for the Brooklyn Dodgers, making history by breaking the color line in baseball. A movie about Robinson, 42, opens this Friday in theaters across the country. Branch Rickey famously said to Jackie Robinson, "I'm looking for a ball player with guts enough not to fight back." Robinson was tested even before he signed with the Dodgers when he played for their farm team in 1946. He faced taunts and threats on the field and couldn't eat in restaurants or stay in hotels in segregated towns. But while he maintained his composure during his baseball career, Jackie Robinson did not hold back when he became an opinion columnist and civil rights champion after he retired from the sport. So today on Radio Times, Jackie Robinson before and after the Brooklyn Dodgers. We have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Chris Lamb is a professor of journalism at Indiana University in Indianapolis, author of a number of books, including Blackout, The Story of Jackie Robinson's First Spring Training, also Conspiracy of Silence, Sports Writers and the Long Campaign to Desegregate Baseball. And Chris Lamb, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
All right, thank you, Marty. It's great to be a part of your program.
Well, thanks so much. Also with us, Michael Long, Associate Professor of Religion and Peace and Conflict Studies at Elizabethtown University. He's also the author, or I should say editor, of a book called Beyond Home Plate, Jackie Robinson on Life After Baseball, including a number of his writings. And Michael Long, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. And Chris, let me begin with you, and then I want to turn to you, Michael, because we're looking at Jackie Robinson before his decade with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I'm curious, Chris, why you were interested in the year 1946 when he was part of the farm team.
Well, the story of Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey is kind of taught as if Branch Rickey rolled out of bed one day in 1946 or 47 and said, "I'm going to sign a black man to play in the major leagues." And you go back and you realize that there's, you know, it's only a tiny bit of the story. When I was working in Daytona Beach, I heard this story, and I had never heard it before about Jackie Robinson. He was signed in October of 1945 for the Montreal Royals. Triple-A baseball team. And the first spring training in 1946, he and his wife are married just a couple weeks, and they travel across the country, and they're kicked off planes because of their skin color. And they get to Daytona Beach, and they start spring training in Sanford, which is where Trayvon Martin's story is happening now. And on the second day, they are told that if you don't leave town by sundown, we're coming to get you. The Klan, and the Klan lets it known that Robinson needs to get out of Sanford. So he and his wife and the sports writers go to Daytona Beach, and that is the only city where he is allowed to play the whole spring training. He's padlocked in Jacksonville. They can't get into the stadium. In DeLand, they cancel a day game because the lights aren't working. When they return to Sanford, they are Robinson is. So it is just a brutal period in Jackie Robinson's life.
And I want to pick up
and
on
he's able it, and it's basically a dress rehearsal
for what he faced.
What's coming.
For what's coming, I do want to pick up on that. Michael Long, it's interesting. Your book is looking at a number of his writings after he retired from baseball, and he is a very outspoken critic of politics, of people, of issues of race and integration.
Yes, in fact, Robinson said, "I think I've become aggressive much more since I left baseball," which is pretty unbelievable or striking and stunning, given the fact that he stole home plate 19 times.
Right.
In fact, he stole home plate in the 1955 World Series, so we can see what Robinson's aggression looks like on the baseball diamond. Remember, he did all this under threats, and I have to follow up on Chris's comment. Robinson received death threats throughout his baseball career and in his post-baseball career. But given that aggression, it's surprising that he said he became much more aggressive after he left baseball. But in fact, he did in many ways in his own mind. He did in a couple different ways as well. He lobbied politicians. He wrote newspaper columns. He constantly wrote politicians as well, trying to advance first-class citizenship for all Americans, especially African-Americans.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at something that he wrote, the New Amsterdam News. This was March 30th, 1960, talking about no more turning the other cheek, where he said, you know, I could act and react just like everybody else in the game. The idea that, as he says, Mr. Branch Rickey's experiment essentially was working, which freed him up to be more opinionated.
Right. And what's really interesting about that column, no more turning the other cheek, is that while Robinson did indeed turn the other cheek in those first couple of years in Major League Baseball, he was not really a pacifist by any stretch of the imagination, nor was he inclined to turn the other cheek. But Branch Rickey was a good Methodist, and he believed in the social principles of Jesus, as he put it, and he asked Robinson to follow the biblical admonition to turn the other cheek. Robinson accepted that sacrifice for the cause of integration of baseball, but he was not personally inclined to do so whatsoever. In fact, he supported the Vietnam War, and he was not a pacifist in terms of foreign policy. He also believed that in those early years of baseball, and he said this later on in his life, he was striking a posture that white Americans really appreciated, and that is the posture of somebody with a bent over back. And Robinson sort of came to resent that, and he believed that he should, throughout the rest of his life, straighten his back and not turn the cheek anymore. He was fiercely aggressive.
Well, let me go back to you, Chris Lamb, because it's an important incident even before Jackie Robinson started playing baseball professionally when he was in the military. He was actually at Fort Hood, Texas. He was told, he was with his wife, sitting on a bus, was told to go to the back of the bus, and he refused. Can you expand on that story?
Yeah, the military had recently desegregated the buses on the base. And he was not with Rachel. He was not quite married at that time. But I believe he was sitting with a woman who was light skinned, and he was ordered to the back of the bus, and he was called boy. And going back to Jackie Robinson's personality, the fact that he would withhold and he would ignore slights is counter to his personality. He is very aggressive from the time he's a little boy, and so now a little kid, and he's sent to the back of the bus, and he's called that horrible name. And he's an officer. He's an officer in the Army, and he refuses to. And he gets off the bus, and he is hot. And the military police are talking down to him, which makes him hotter. And he is court-martialed. And he goes before a court-martial trial in shackles. And if he had not been well-known, he was at this point a very well-known college athlete. If he had not been well-known, he probably would have been sent to Fort Leavenworth and would have been in prison when Branch Rickey was looking for the right person to desegregate baseball. But no, he is somebody who has a short fuse. And the fact that he sacrificed himself, you know, for the betterment of baseball and society, it just speaks volumes about him.
And is that how you see it, that the fact that he held back the kind of legitimate rage that he might have felt, that really had stresses on him personally?
Oh, I think that it led to his early death. He was 53, and he was white-haired, and he could blind, and he was crippled. He had diabetes, but, you know, this guy, for his whole lifetime, was you know, walking into a 50-mile-an-hour wind every day he lived, it seemed, and it just wore him out.
There's something in your book about with some of the writings of Jackie Robinson, Michael Long, where he does talk about Branch Rickey, and he says this was in the New York Post, 1959. He says, "I've always thought and spoken of him as Mr. Rickey, not because of any formality, not certainly because of any deference, but just because of the true gentleman that he is. From the day I first met him in his office in 1945 until the present, I've been able to count on him for some kind of support, guidance, and just plain friendship." Do you think there was a kind of father-son relationship there?
Oh, Jackie Robinson loved Branch Rickey, and Branch Rickey loved Robinson as well as his own son. And yes, I do think that there was a father-son relationship. Robinson, to follow up on Chris's comments, really traced his aggression to his childhood. He says it in his later writings that my childhood is why I try to win all the time. And he had a difficult childhood. His parents split when he was just a young toddler, and he never really enjoyed great material wealth by any stretch of the imagination and faced racist taunts even as a youngster and became extremely competitive. And that fueled his success on and off the field, I believe. Branch Rickey recognized that early on. And he saw in Robinson something that was more than a great baseball player. He saw a steely character and somebody who wouldn't hit back initially. And he really took Robinson under his wing and became protective of him in many ways. And while Robinson enjoyed that really close relationship with Branch Rickey, considering him the father that he never had, he had that relationship with Rickey the rest of his life, and he never had that same relationship with Walter O'Malley, who became the owner of the Dodgers later on.
Let me go back to you, Chris Lamb. Your book is about that first spring training for Jackie Robinson. How did he perform on the field? How did he perform as a player?
At the beginning, not very well. He was under a lot of pressure. He was having trouble hitting the ball. He was trying to impress the coaches by throwing, so he throws his arm out. So now he can't throw, he can't hit. Mm. And the sports writers, the white sports writers, are grumbling that he's only there because he's black. And it just takes a devastating toll on him. And eventually he learns to bunt, and Rickey puts him at first base, which doesn't require a strong throwing arm. And he, once he begins bunting, he has incredible speed, as Michael referred to. And he's able to get some hits and leg out some hits, and his confidence comes back. And by the end of the spring training, he's hitting well. And he makes such an impact on Daytona Beach that the little kids, the teenage boys, are, as the train pulls out of Daytona Beach, they are chasing after the train. And when the train is out of sight, that they put their ears to the tracks because they want to become a part of Jackie Robinson as long as they can.
Well, and that's a very poignant story. But it sounds like he won over, probably not all, but some of the spectators. Chris?
He won over everybody. He has this, you know, in the hero's journey, we talk about redemption. Well, Robinson never needed to be redeemed. He redeemed us all. His manager was a guy named Clay Hopper, who was from Mississippi. He was a cotton broker and wanted no part of Robinson. And he didn't want to shake Robinson's hand. He didn't want to manage Robinson. He asked Rickey to move him to another team. And yet, by the end of the season, Clay Hopper is an enthusiastic supporter of Jackie Robinson. In fact, during the spring, he sees Robinson make a great play, and he turns to Rickey, and Hopper says, "Do you really think a Negro is a human being?" Mm-hmm. And Rickey thinks Hopper's going to have a mental breakdown. Wow. But Hopper comes around, and he becomes redeemed through Jackie Robinson. And that's kind of what the civil rights, you know, movement is about. As Michael's book, which I just finished, is terrific about Robinson and civil rights.
Well, I want to pick up on all of that after a very short break. That's Chris Lamb. He's a professor of journalism at Indiana University in Indianapolis, author of a number of books, including one called Blackout, the story of Jackie Robinson's first spring training, and Conspiracy of Silence, Sports Writers and the Long Campaign to Desegregate Baseball. Michael Long, also with us, associate professor of religion, peace, and conflict studies at Elizabethtown University, and has a special interest in letters and has a book that he has edited called Beyond Home Plate, Jackie Robinson on Life After Baseball, which includes a number of his writings. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More at Lincoln.com.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company and its revival of Permanent Collection. Inspired by the Barnes Museum, this gripping drama follows the newly hired executive director whose ideas for changing the Permanent Collection ignite a racially charged controversy. Permanent Collection runs now through May 5th. For tickets, 215-568-8079 or online at interacttheater.org.
This is Terry Gross. Join me Sunday afternoon, May 5th, at the McCarter Theater in Princeton for Off Air with Fresh Air. I'll talk about my adventures hosting Fresh Air, play clips of interviews in which things didn't exactly go as expected, and then you could give me a taste of my own medicine during the Q&A. There will be more to see than just me. We'll have animations by WHYY's digital artist-in-residence, Tony Off. For information, visit whyy.org/events.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about Jackie Robinson. A new movie about the baseball great opens this Friday. It's called 42, certainly about how he broke the color line in professional baseball when he started playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. Well, today we're looking at the year before, 1946, and we're also looking at the years after he retired from the sport when he became a very outspoken columnist and champion for civil rights and racial equality. Our guests are Chris Lamb and Michael Long, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Chris, if I can go back to you, and just because we're talking about the late 40s and into the 1950s, this was before the Voting Rights Act. This was when it was illegal for black and white couples to be married in a number of states, including many of the ones in the South. It's just, I think it's important to sort of pause and remember what America was like back then. Can you expand on that?
Oh, absolutely. The integration of baseball is the most important civil rights story in the years immediately following World War II, and Jackie Robinson is the most important civil rights figure in those years. It's a decade before, as you mentioned, Brown versus Board of Education, Emmett Till, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King. In fact, Martin Luther King once said of his friend Jackie Robinson that he was a freedom rider before freedom rides and a sit-inner before sit-ins. And when Robinson went to Florida for that first spring training, he was a smart guy, and he knew there was a chance that he would not be coming back alive, because blacks who confronted segregation in those years were frequently arrested and beaten and lynched.
So his, I mean, and clearly, as you describe, and as he has talked about, he was a very vulnerable person in a dangerous part of the country.
And there wasn't much he could do about it, you know. And that's what—that's the supreme heroism and sacrifice. I mean, who would do this? I mean, it wasn't that he didn't know what was going on. He knew all about racism from the time he was growing up in Pasadena and through college and through at the military. He knew what could happen, and yet he did it anyway.
Well, Michael,
and it changed, and it had a profound effect on millions of people who had never given this issue any thought until he came along.
Michael, you want to add to that?
Oh, absolutely. I want to follow up on Chris's comments that Jackie was a civil rights champion. He was indeed. He was a civil rights leader, not only in 45, 46, and 47, but far beyond home plate as well. And Rachel Robinson has described Jackie as civil rights, an informal civil rights leader. Well, I think that's being modest. I think Robinson belongs in the Hall of Fame of civil rights leaders, beginning not only in the years that Chris looks at, but in those years beyond home plate, when he's working for the NAACP, when he's strategizing with kids from CORE, when he's working with Martin Luther King Jr. in Albany and Birmingham, when he's taking a public stance against Malcolm X, and so much more. I mean, the guy was fiercely aggressive in civil rights. He's a civil rights champion.
Well, let me, and I want to read some of what he wrote, speaking directly to what you were just talking about there, Michael. But Chris, let me go back to you, because we also have, after in the 40s and 50s, soldiers coming back from the Second World War, and I'm interested in how, and the fact that Jackie Robinson served in the military, how you think that inspired him as a civil rights person, and perhaps even inspired him on the baseball field.
Well, I think that Branch Rickey, to his credit, he's almost doing central casting to try to find this player. And the fact that I went to college, the fact that Jackie Robinson was in the military was a part of that. And he was a terrific athlete who performed better under pressure. And the fact that the military, World War II changed racial attitudes in America. So many white soldiers went over there and served with blacks and watched blacks bleed red and watch blacks die in foxholes and watch blacks fight heroically, that changed the way that they thought about blacks. So there was this change. There was this new world in 1946. And so it really made a difference. And Robinson's, his his inner strength is, as Michael said, it's mm-hmm. from his earliest day. He never sees his father. And he goes and he's always fighting. He's always fighting. And he's always fighting, as Michael's book indicates, up until he dies.
Well, in fact, and I'm kind of toggling back and forth between the 40s and 50s and even into the 60s, I want to quote something that Jackie Robinson wrote to Dwight D. Eisenhower. This was May 13th, 1958. And he says to the president, "I was sitting in the audience at the summit meeting of Negro leaders yesterday when you said we must have patience. On hearing you say that, I felt like standing up and saying, oh, no, not again. I respectfully remind you, sir, that we have been the most patient of all people." He also wrote to John Kennedy saying, you know, we have been patient and we're frankly sick and tired of waiting. These are powerful and very eloquent letters.
Well, Robinson met Eisenhower in 1953 at a nationally televised speech that Eisenhower was giving before the Anti-Defamation League. And at the end of the speech, he made a beeline for Jackie, and Jackie was just smitten, and this was on national television, and later wrote President Eisenhower about his great faith in democracy. But before long, Robinson had turned bitter towards Eisenhower. He thought that Eisenhower should have acted when there were bombings in Montgomery, Alabama in 1956. He felt that Eisenhower dragged his feet in civil rights legislation. He felt that Eisenhower was way too patient, way too moderate in his approach to advancing civil rights legislation, especially when Eisenhower said things like, "There are no revolutionary cures for our racial ills," and called for patience. Well, Robinson had no patience at that point in his life, and he was very clear about telling that not only to somebody standing next to him, but to the President of the United States as well. He did not hold back. He did the same thing with Kennedy. He was no fan of Kennedy at all. He met with Kennedy when John F. Kennedy was running for the president at a private home in Georgetown, and he felt that Kennedy never really looked him in the eye. And mm-hmm. Kennedy also said that he wasn't really aware of the problems that blacks faced. And Kennedy and Robinson never really became friends. In fact, Robinson sides with Nixon against Kennedy in the 1960 presidential race. Well, and Robinson constantly criticized Kennedy.
And I want to pick up on that as well. Chris, let me go back to you if I could, because part of what you've been writing about was the press coverage of Jackie Robinson and the role that the Black Weekly papers played in covering him, and even the role that the Daily Worker, the communist or the socialist paper played in promoting integration and also promoting Jackie Robinson.
Oh, yes. You can't have the integration of baseball when it did without the long campaign. In the parallel universe of white and black America, there's very little said in the white press, even though white sports writers know that there are black ball players as good as any white ball player. And from 1933 until 1945, the black press and the Daily Worker are hammering at this issue. And the Daily Worker is involved in organized labor, and Daily Worker's involved with progressive politicians all over New York to pass legislation, and they are a continual irritant to Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and they just keep hammering away. But as soon as Ricky, who is an anti-communist, signs Robinson, Ricky takes full credit for the story, and the white press lets him do it. And in the story of the black sports writers and the communist sports writers become forgotten for a long time.
And that's Chris Lamb, again, a professor of journalism at Indiana University in Indianapolis. We are talking about Jackie Robinson, someone he has written about, including in a book called Blackout, the story of Jackie Robinson's first spring training and Conspiracy of Silence, Sports Writers and the Long Campaign to Desegregate Baseball, something he just referenced. Also with us, Michael Long, Associate Professor of Religion, Peace, and Conflict Studies at Elizabethtown University. And his new book, which he edited, is called Beyond Home Plate, Jackie Robinson on Life After Baseball. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like James from Levittown to join us. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi. I was just wondering if your guests knew anything about or could say anything about Moses Fleetwood Walker. He was, from what I understand, he was the first to break the color barrier in 1884. He played for the Toledo Blue Stockings, I think it was.
James, let me see if Chris Lamb can respond to that. Chris?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There were two black major leaguers in 1884. Moses Fleetwood Walker, who is an incredible story, who we probably don't, you know, can't give deserves the kind of a time that that he deserves. Yeah, he played for the, you're absolutely right, the Toledo Blue Stockings for a year. He was a tremendous catcher. And the pitcher, his, and this is back when a starting pitcher would start 80 games in a season, but he would refuse to take signals from a black man. So, and so Walker was a catcher, and he played the entire season without knowing what pitch his pitcher was throwing.
Wow.
And he was done in the majors after that year, and there would not be another black in the major leagues until 1947.
But would it be fair to say that, that he, well, I don't know if there was a color line back in the 19th century, in 1884.
There was it began. It was created in 1887, and they called it a gentleman's agreement. There was nothing that was signed, which made it convenient for the owners. But before that, dozens of blacks had played in organized baseball, and then that pretty much stopped in 1887.
Let me see what George from Reading has to say. George, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is, I know we've come a long way, but have we really made any landmark in spite of Robinson dominating basketball, football? Has it changed? Do they still see the black man as a threat? Because there are some. I had a nephew that went out for hockey, and he was all but taunted out of the whole the idea of him playing hockey.
Because it was considered a quote-unquote white sport, George?
That's what was told to him, and they politely said, you know, go back where you belong. Go shoot hoops or something.
Oh, wow. Well,
wow.
I'm sorry.
I come from, Colquitt County, Georgia, so I understand, you know, a lot of the segregation, stuff
sure.
like that, but, you know, I just want to know, has it changed?
Well,
I mean, I don't really see it. But
no, fair enough. George, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Michael, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, sure. I think that it has changed, and we do see lots of African Americans playing sports. So fewer in Major League Baseball, and Chris can speak to that. So let's not lose sight of the fact that desegregation has changed in a lot of sports. Though there are some sports like hockey where we see issues of troubling race issues. Let me make a bigger point and say that race still does matter. Robinson does still matter in the wake of this recent recession. African Americans are unemployed at a rate of 1.5 to 2 times greater than whites. Nearly a third between 18 and 24 are unemployed. And the median wealth of white household was 20 times that of black households, according to Pew Research Center. Race matters. Jackie Robinson still matters. And on that point of economics, if I can just follow up, Robinson founded the Freedom Bank in Harlem in 1964 so he could give local residents to have a say in their economic lives, so they could get loans unavailable to them elsewhere, so they could get decent interest rates that they couldn't get anywhere else. Robinson was really concerned about the poverty that his fellow African Americans faced.
And that, of course, was after he retired from baseball. Chris, you want to weigh in on that as well?
There was actually a TV commercial that's very poignant that showed during the NCAA basketball tournament that showed a young African American boy playing hockey. But yes, he does matter. And on Monday is Jackie Robinson Day, and Major League ball players will talk about how inspiring he is and what a role model he is and what a difference he's made in their lives. But I'm thinking that they don't really know Jack, because I don't think that most Major League ball players would take on any issue that's bigger than their wallets. I mean, they have the power to change society, and they don't. And if they really want to honor Jackie Robinson's memory, that's how they could do it.
Oh, interesting. Thanks for calling.
And Robinson frequently Robinson frequently criticized his fellow athletes, fellow African-American athletes, for not standing up as much as they could have to advance civil rights. There's no doubt about that. The other The other really interesting thing is that Robinson devoted his entire life to civil rights. I mean, he did not devote his life to being in commercials and playing golf the rest of his life. He devoted it to advancing civil rights. And the older he became, I think the angrier he became with the United States and its indifference to racial issues.
Chris, we're calling you here from Philadelphia, of course, home of the Phillies, and I want to just ask you about Ben Chapman, who was a manager of the Phillies when Jackie Robinson was playing for the Dodgers, and everything I read about him, frankly, I'm embarrassed and shocked that a manager in the city of Philadelphia would be, frankly, so racist.
Oh, he's a rotten guy, and it's in case, and, you know, sometimes it's nice to come across somebody who is just so absolutely rotten. And yeah, he is so nasty to Robinson that Robinson at one point says to himself, "I want her to just say, you know, the heck with this experiment, and I want her to walk into the dugout and wring that guy's neck." He said it a little bit more passionately than I did, but he also speaks for the South, and he also speaks for a lot of the United States who believe that blacks didn't belong in baseball or didn't belong in any kind of equality. But yeah, he's an absolutely rotten guy, and his good friend is Dixie Walker, who is Robinson's teammate. And Dixie Walker comes around and sees how good Robinson is and becomes redeemed as well. But no, Chapman is just an awful human being.
I mean, it's really race baiting. Yeah, go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
Well, Robinson, just to spread the love around a little bit.
Oh, right in.
Considered Tom Yawkey of the Boston Red Sox to be the most bigoted guy in baseball, and that's an expression that he used several times. He had no positive feelings about Yawkey or the Red Sox Nation. Mm. So just to spread the love around, there you go.
Well, there you go. Well, and Philadelphia, I don't think it's referred to this anymore, but at one point called the northernmost southern city in America at the time. You know, Chris, it's interesting to think about Jackie Robinson. And again, just I think to underscore what we were saying at the beginning of the hour about the kind of stresses that he must have been on or under and the responsibility that he was shouldering largely by himself to not just integrate baseball, but also to hold the aspirations of African Americans and others in this country.
When he gets to Florida after this 36-hour airplane ordeal from Los Angeles to Daytona Beach, and he is just fighting mad, and he's there with two black sports writers, Wendell Smith and Billy Rill, the Pittsburgh Courier, and he tells them, "I want to quit. There's no way this is going to work. There's no way I'm going to get any equality."
And this is 1946,
This is 1946, and the sports writers stay up with him all night telling him, "You don't have a choice. You signed up for this. The hopes and dreams of 13 million blacks are with you. You have to go ahead with this. Everything you do is going to represent black people. When you strike out, it's going to represent black people. When you hit a home run, it's going to represent black people. You have to do this." And the stress is so big on him that during spring training, his wife finds out she's pregnant and doesn't tell him. Because she knows the kind of stress that he's under.
Well, we're gonna take gonna take another short break and get back to our conversation because the new movie 42 is opening this weekend. We're talking with two historians about Jackie Robinson's legacy on and off the field. We'll take a very short break, and I do want to play a clip from a speech he gave in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963. After this very short break, stay with us. We'll be right back.
PIFA, a Kimmel Center production, supports WHYY and presents City Tavern's Chef Walter Stabe in A Taste of History, Saturday, April 13th at the Kimmel Center. On the 270th anniversary of Thomas Jefferson's birth, Chef Stabe embarks on a culinary adventure celebrating the food and history of our founding fathers. Jefferson, Washington, and Adams leap out of the history books and onto the stage. Lead sponsor TD Bank. Tickets at PIFA.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg responds to critics and is cheered by supporters of her lean-in philosophy for women at our recent sit-down. We'll bring it to you. Also, what's really going to happen to healthcare premiums under Obamacare? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Founded in 1799, Westtown School invites students pre-K through grade 12 to pursue a life-size education, one that helps to prepare each student for what comes next, not only for college and career, but for a whole life. You can learn more by attending Westtown School's open house on Monday, April 15th at 9 a.m. Details about the open house at westtown.edu. Westtown School, a life-size education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about Jackie Robinson on and off the field. And here he is speaking at a rally in Birmingham, Alabama. This is the evening of Monday, May 13th, 1963. He's there along with Reverend Ralph Abernathy and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Let's listen.
I don't think you realize down here in Birmingham what you mean to us up there in New York. And I don't think that white Americans understand what Birmingham means to all of us throughout this country. When we think about the little kids being tossed from one side of the street to the other by the tremendous force of this hose, and we think about, this picture just sickens me, this big brave policeman down here with his knee on the throat of this lady. And the problem of it is, ladies and gentlemen, is that this same picture of the dogs and of this policeman with his knee in the throat of this lady, it's a picture that's being portrayed throughout the world. And I think the conscience of America is beginning to awaken. I think the first steps that were made here by the Birmingham businessmen with Dr. King and the other leaders down here is an indication that perhaps the conscience of Birmingham is beginning to awaken. The only thing that we are demanding is that we be allowed to move ahead just like any other American citizen.
And again, Jackie Robinson speaking in 1963. We're talking about Jackie Robinson, both on and off the field, with Chris Lamb and Michael Long, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mike, I want to read a letter that Jackie Robinson wrote to President Kennedy, May 7th, 1963. And this is also referencing the civil rights activism and demonstrations in Birmingham, Alabama. He says, "I submit that you do not have the... I submit that you do have the power to cut off federal expenditures within a state which has become a police state and to declare martial law for the purpose of guaranteeing the safety of American citizens. The eyes of the world are on America, and Americans of both races are looking to you." That's Jackie Robinson writing to President Kennedy.
I'm glad you played that clip and read that letter, in part because sometimes I believe that we freeze Robinson unfairly in 1947. We picture him as this young, smiling baseball player who gently integrates baseball. And I think that's unfair to Robinson in some ways. He considered his exploits beyond the baseball diamond to be the most meaningful in his life. And those include his work in Birmingham and his lobbying of President Kennedy for civil rights legislation and for the protection of civil rights workers in Birmingham, especially at that point. He was really angry at this point in his life. And by the end of his life, he's actually saying things like this: "I can't stand and salute the flag. I can't stand for the national anthem." He becomes so disenchanted with policies in terms of race that he becomes disheartened in many ways. And it's sad to see. Mm-hmm. He's a national icon. He played America's game. But by the end of his life, he becomes very upset with America, and he boils. At the same time, he's this great, loving father. We can't lose sight of that. He becomes extremely angry at the end of his life, but he has this beautiful dimension to him at home that Rachel Robinson sees all the time that the rest of the public does not get to see. So he's very multidimensional. He has a lot of different parts of his character.
Let me get some more callers in. It looks like we have Harold from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Harold, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, my name is Harold Yates, and for me, Jackie Robinson was my mentor. And long before this idea of giving back to the community and all these platitudes about social responsibility, Jackie Robinson used to visit us at the Harlem YMCA.
Wow.
Every Saturday morning from 10 a.m. till noon, and he would personally counsel. There were about a dozen of us. And we were part of the Second Century Club, the Second Century of the YMCA. And he introduced me to my first public speech, which was made before all the elected officials and the New York City administration. And as a result of that, I got into communications. And since then, I went from there to school to study communications. I was the press officer for the entire U.S. Coast Guard. I was a producer-director over here at Channel 3 for about 10 years. And after that, I went to Environmental Protection Agency, where I was a public affairs specialist and headed up the Superfund Community Relations Program for the regional area, for the five-state area. But Jackie Robinson personally came there and talked to us. He brought experts in, professionals for us to meet, and he did mentoring before people even talked about it. And this was back in 1953, 54, and 55.
Well, Harold, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Actually, Chris, let me just give you a chance to respond. What do you say?
Boy, I'm not sure I can, Marty. it was so well put, and I just think that Jackie Robinson had this absolutely profound impact on so many people. I mean, I was born after he retired, and yet I've been Jackie Robinson has sort of been my mentor for 20 years.
Your thoughts, Mike?
I never knew.
Well, may I follow up too, Marty?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
That's a great story, Harold, and thanks for sharing that. And especially because Robinson often said that he did what he did, and that is to fight for first-class citizenship, so that his children and all of our children could live in dignity. And so he went to the Harlem Y. He went to play Santa Claus with underprivileged children, believe it or not. I love the image of Jackie Robinson playing Santa Claus. He went to juvenile detention centers. He traveled all around to be with children and youth so that they could live lives marked by dignity and would not have to experience the same types of injustices that he experienced as a child. And so just to hear Harold give that testimony of sorts is a rich tribute to Robinson's legacy. That is Jackie Robinson's legacy.
Harold,
you are Jackie Robinson's legacy.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Harold. Thank you so much. Let me just do a very weird segue, but I think if we want to understand the full Jackie Robinson, here's something that he said, Michael, in the New York Amsterdam News about Barry Goldwater. He says, in my opinion, he is a bigot, an advocate of white supremacy, and more dangerous than Governor Wallace. That was George Wallace. If Senator Goldwater announced a change in views, I would not believe in him. I would believe that he was trying to calm down some of the terrific opposition, which his racist statements and attitudes have brought down upon him from members of his own party, the Republican Party at the time. So clearly sort of underscoring the fact that Jackie Robinson was a man of deep conviction and deep feelings.
Oh, he couldn't stand Barry Goldwater.
Clearly.
He called him a bigot. He called him a bigot, and he called him a menace to our country in 1964 when Goldwater is running for the presidency. He believes that Goldwater is wrong in terms of advocating for state rights, and he believes that Barry Goldwater is trigger happy. He's disappointed that Goldwater voted against civil rights legislation. He finds Goldwater extremist in so many ways. In fact, he writes Goldwater a letter in 1964 after Goldwater asked for a meeting. And he says, look, you called for extremism, and right now it's coming right back at you in Molotov cocktails. Whoa. What do you say now? And why are you getting in bed with the slimiest elements of our nation, KKK and the John Birchers? This is what Jackie Robinson is saying. And why didn't you vote for legislation? And so forth and so on. He refuses to meet with Goldwater, and Goldwater doesn't reply to that letter at all.
Well, and we should also say that he was a critic of the Dixiecrats within the Democratic Party, obviously because of their ties to you know, racial segregation and problems in the South.
This is the best thing about Jackie Robinson. He criticizes anybody and everybody who does not advance civil rights as he believes it should be advanced, and those include Democrats, Republicans, and anybody else. He criticizes Kennedy. He criticizes Johnson. He criticizes Nixon. He criticizes Goldwater. He even criticizes Nelson Rockefeller in 1972. He did not hold back when he felt as if politicians were not advancing civil rights.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have John from Langhorne joining us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty.
Sure.
Here's my question. There's so much in Jackie's life to be angry and bitter about, so much in America. when he died at the end of his life, was he personally a happy man? Did he know how much he really was beloved, not just by blacks, but even by some whites? Or did he die still a bitter person?
Chris, you want to take that, Chris Lamb?
I don't think he was. I think when his son died, I think it really took so much out of him. No, I mean, I think Michael can probably answer this question better than I, but I don't think he was. I mean, in his last public appearance, he speaks at the 1972 World Series, and he says, "I'm not going to be satisfied until I look over at the dugouts and see a black manager." And that really is his last public statement, and he's dead probably 10 days later or so. No, I don't think he really had a lot of happy moments, and it's an awful shame.
What do you think?
He brought so much happiness to everybody else.
Indeed, yeah. Michael, your thoughts?
Well, the last 8 years or so of his life were difficult, partly because he's suffering so much from diabetes as well and is in a lot of pain. And I did talk with Rachel about this, and she wanted me to remember that while he could sound angry in his letters and in his columns, the Jackie Robinson that she experienced wasn't like that. She experienced somebody who loved to spend time with her and who loved to spend time with his children and who just loved to be in the presence of children and youth. And so the one she remembers is tender-hearted, caring, sensitive, even vulnerable. And those are strange adjectives to use for Jackie Robinson in many ways, I believe. But she was very emphatic. Rachel Robinson was very emphatic in making that point when I talked with her about Beyond Home Plate. She did not want me to lose sight of that in light of Robinson's fierce prophecy near the end of his life, that he was still somebody who was in love with her and who loved life and who tried to live it to its fullest.
Let me get Dave from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Thank you so much
for this conversation.
I just want to speak to the transformative power of sports and thank Jackie Robinson, because being a baby boomer, and now now I'm old enough to see the bigger picture. I can people ahead of me, like my father, were very racist, and I grew up in Pittsburgh, my icon happened to be Roberto Clemente. But Jackie Robinson opened the door for these other players. And my peers and I, growing up, we didn't care what color they were. We just wanted to be like them. And we were able to see equality in a different way than previous generations. So I'm really grateful for that.
Well, Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Chris Lamb, I'm giving you a chance to respond. What do you think?
I think because of the movie, because of programs like yours, Jackie Robinson is finally getting the credit he's long deserved. I'm a coach on my 11-year-old's baseball team, and there are 10 kids, and they went around and asked all the kids who their favorite baseball player was. 3 of the 10 said Jackie Robinson. I just think that says something about maybe the state of Jackie Robinson today.
What do you think, Michael?
I wish we had more African Americans in baseball, and maybe Chris can speak to that. But absolutely. And the other important thing, just to follow up on that, is that at this point, when Jackie Robinson is in breaking the color barrier, baseball is America's game. And so he became uniquely an American hero through that sports venue. And I think the caller is absolutely right. The transformative power of America's game and changing the character of American society happened with Jackie Robinson.
We're almost out of time here, and we have a caller who has a question. I want to toss it to you, Michael, which is why Jackie Robinson was a supporter of Richard Nixon. And I know he was a critic as well, but is there a short answer to that, like a 30-second answer?
Sure. Nixon had been making pro-civil rights statements in the 1950s. In 1957, he advanced civil rights legislation in Congress. He toured Africa. And then in 1959, he chose Henry Cabot Lodge, who was racially progressive, as his running mate. Now, Robinson sours on Nixon in 1960 because he believed that he ignored the African-American vote and because he didn't call Martin Luther King Jr. when King was serving time in prison. And then he believed he sours on Nixon even more when he believes that he just writes off the African-American vote altogether when he runs for president.
Mm. Chris Lamb, are you looking forward to seeing the movie 42, which opens on Friday?
Yes, I am. I'm going to see it tomorrow night in Kansas City.
And how about for you, Michael?
Oh, my gosh, I can't wait. I've heard from Rachel, from Sharon Robinson, that the family thinks it's a great movie, and let's all go see it.
Let's all do that. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Michael Long, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty. It's great chatting with you and Chris. Hey, Chris.
And Chris.
Thank you, Marty, and it's a terrific book, Michael.
Well, thanks, Chris. Yours as well.
Okay, too much lovey-dovey here on Radio Times. No, my thanks to both of you, Chris Lamb, and also to Michael Long. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Heather Bromfield helping us out today as our intern. Emily Bryant helping us out as well. And Sophie Reed producing one of the programs today on Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We want to close things out with the 1949 version of Did You See Jackie Robinson and Hit the Ball, written by Buddy Johnson, performed by Count Basie.
Yeah! Yeah! Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? It went zooming across the left field wall. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
And when he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball. Satchel Paige is mellow, so is Campanella. Newcomb and Dobie too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Jackie Robinson hit that ball. Did he hit it? Yes! And that ain't all. He's so
whole. Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.